Well, we have a great one today, you know, for a change. I'm going to be talking to Lawrence O'Donnell Jr. Lawrence, of course, is the host of MSNBC's The Last Word, the network's second highest rated program after Rachel Maddow's show. She delivers Lawrence a huge lead-in, and what percentage of her audience do you lose?
I squander a minimum of 10%. On a good night, I lose 10%. On an average night, I lose, I don't know, a little more than that. I don't know.
And do you know when you lose them? I mean, she does this thing where she tosses off to you and you're on split screen. Mm-hmm. I imagine the Rachel aficionados stay for that.
I would if I was a Rachel aficionado. Why would you leave? She's still talking. You
know, yes. And then when the split screen goes to you, well, then they leave.
I would assume there's a cliff there. You know, I've never seen them, but the way we got our ratings are in 15-minute blocks, mm-hmm. right? So I will see the hour divided into 15-minute blocks, right. And so I see what that first basically 15 minutes is, and that's always the highest. They do minute by minute ratings.
You have to ask
for them, and it takes them a while to develop them, and they give them to you. Because I could see then, from the minute to minute, the second she says, you know, good night, like what happens?
The minute it goes full screen to you,
I
would love to see that.
Yeah.
Would you find that
out
for me?
Yeah, we'll find it.
Okay, at least we got a project here.
It's worth knowing.
Well, anyway, I think everyone enjoys that segment.
It's called a tease, right? We're going to, like, so now we say we're going to talk about that.
Well, you're the broadcaster.
I'd hang around to listen to that, because that sounds interesting.
When I did my radio show for Air America, I did not know that you tease.
Yeah.
And by the time I figured it out, I just went, oh, Jesus. It was too late, I felt, to just sound like I know to do teases. So what I would do is this. I'd go, you won't believe what we got for you coming back.
Yeah.
So I just made fun of the tease.
Right, right.
This is partly my problem because I'm a comedian.
No, but it's a huge advantage to be able to make fun of those kinds of rituals within broadcasting.
Cause you don't.
I can't because for a bunch of reasons. I'm not funny enough. The audience doesn't get it. You know, on cable news, if you're going to do something that's a joke, you must have a graphic that says this is a joke.
At MSNBC, every show is the same show. It's a host and then guests from the Southern District of New York, mm-hmm. former prosecutor.
There's a lot of them. There's a lot of those.
But if you
Southern
don't have
District.
A... you know, prosecutor from the Southern District of New York, you have one from the Eastern District.
Yeah. I think I might be the only one who's had one from the Northern District.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've
never had one from the Western District. That's Buffalo. We've never had one.
I think you had the Royal Flush once.
I've tried to. Yeah.
You know, yes. Former prosecutor from the Southern District, Eastern District, and Northern District.
You know what? If
District,
I haven't,
I was
I'm going to try to do that. That'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah. And I, especially at a certain phase of the Mueller report and the impeachment investigation, you would have those three lawyers on, and very, very brilliant lawyers. I will say that all your guests are terrific. And, I'd hear something like the former prosecutor from Southern District of New York say, like, I was very interested. I thought it was fascinating what Manafort's lawyer, how he pleaded or how he asked for this change in venue. And that tells me, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And you would say, that's fascinating. And it wasn't.
Oh, it was to me. Because I grew up with lawyers, and so I mean, I see details in that stuff that absolutely does fascinate me. I can't guarantee anyone in the audience shares that feeling, but all that stuff really is fascinating.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get into it then. You spent your time around lawyers, and one of those lawyers that you spent your time around was your dad.
Yep.
Lawrence O'Donnell Sr.
Correct. And he started off as a Boston cop, and when I was a baby, I guess, and he was that kind of Boston Irish wise guy who's sitting there on the witness stand as a patrolman, listening to these lawyers ask him questions, and he's thinking with all the arrogance that he had in him, I could do that, and so
it's really a good thing that you didn't inherit any of that.
No, exactly right. And so, he was a high school graduate and barely a high school graduate. Terrible student.
Did he grow up in Dorchester like you did?
No, he grew up in even harder turf of Roxbury and Jamaica Plain. And
Roxbury, though.
You know, all those used to be, when he was a kid, those were Irish neighborhoods, which by the time I was a kid had become black neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so I was growing up in Dorchester, which is the largest of the
I like that when you talk about Dorchester, you can't talk about it.
You can't. You just
the largest.
No, you can't.
Okay, let's for the next few minutes, you talk Dorchester, and I'll talk Minnesota.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you this. So your dad. You know, he barely made it out of high school, according to you. And, and then he is a cop. And I guess I would suppose there are a lot of Boston cops in Dorchester.
The Dorchester, the fathers were all like cops, fire, and, post office, and carpenters, plumbers, that stuff. And so, yeah, it was just all over the culture of where we were. I mean, that was what we were, that was the route that was available to us.
And so okay, so now he's a bad student.
Yeah.
Right, in high school, and then he's a cop, and he's seeing these, he's testifying, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says, no, I witnessed this guy doing this thing, and then he's the lawyer for the perpetrator, is kind of dumb, he thinks, right?
He thinks they all are. And so he thinks he's smarter than all of them, including the judge. And so he gets into his head, he's going to go to college and law school nights, and everyone thinks he's crazy, and no one thinks he can do it. And my mother doesn't think he can do it, but my mother doesn't tell him that. My mother's the only one who doesn't say, you can't do this. Everyone else says, you can't do this, you're crazy, okay? So, my father becomes a lawyer.
We can drop the...
Yeah, I think the audience, will have a better time.
Yeah, because we were thinking about our actions.
Yeah, but, I did have to overcome that. I had to learn to speak American, which was wicked hot. I mean, wicked hot.
It's a great accent.
No, but when I... No, see, SNL made it a great accent. You got to understand before...
No, Ben Affleck.
Yeah, but a movie doesn't hit the way SNL did it repeatedly. And so the problem with having that accent, certainly before Good Will Hunting...
Matt Damon.
And before SNL, was no one knew what your accent was. They just thought you were stupid.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Your mom gets him through law school. That's not an accredited law school.
No, that's right. He went to Suffolk Law School in Boston, which is now a very reputable place. But at the time, it was not. Suffolk College was not an accredited college. Suffolk Law School was not an accredited law school. It's a commuter school in downtown Boston. And he got through there, and then he took the bar exam a few times, as he had to, and, became a lawyer, and became a great lawyer, became a really great lawyer.
And part of that is he's really smart.
Yeah.
He has street smarts.
Yeah.
He knows people. And your first book, Deadly Force, which you wrote about a case that he handled as a lawyer, where Boston cops had shot and killed an African American young man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
25 years old.
And it was this was kind of the first book, I think, written about something that is very, very present and on Americans' minds.
Yeah, it was the first book, 1984, and it was the only book for decades, actually. No, there was zero interest
in the subject. And how long did it take you to write that book? It
took me 7 years to write that book, mostly because I didn't know how to write. And the other half of it was there was an ongoing research, and the case was ongoing legally in the courts.
But that was the 7 years in which people thought weren't going to amount to anything.
Correct. It looks like, on my resume, that 7 years looks like prison time because it's just a blank. Like, there's nothing, you know. Actually, I was a substitute teacher and a packing attendant in Boston at the same time.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, this is a case that your dad represented the...
Yeah, it was a civil rights case, and it was the kind of the first of its kind, and he won. You know, he brought this case against his old police department, the Boston Police Department, and he won it, and it had never been done before, and he kind of set out a novel path that other lawyers have tried to follow, and many have successfully followed since then. And it was an incredibly dramatic story, and it just requires everything you know that my father's life included, right up to the moment where James Bowden's widow walks into his office and tells the story of her husband being killed by the Boston police and asks if he will take the case. And he immediately took the case. He had the kind of experience to know
it takes a former cop.
Yeah.
To do this.
Yeah, and I'll give you one example from the trial, which was jury selection. And this is about the kind of intelligence, the kind of smarts that he had, and it's the kind of stuff that doesn't show up on, you know, the bar exam, and so he's not one of those guys who tested well academically.
He's not book smart.
What's so interesting is you would say he wasn't book smart in, say, high school or college, right? But then when he becomes a lawyer, he actually does the work of studying the law books, and so when he gets in the courtroom, if you want to do law book mastery against law book mastery of the other side or the judge, he's going to beat them all. Like in jury selection on this trial, it was very difficult. You know, you actually have very few challenges against the jury, and so my brother Michael was
You're given a number of challenges?
Yeah, there's a fixed number in federal court, number. And so my brother Michael was his co-counsel on the case, and I was sitting there in the front row of the courtroom as a kind of extra assistant because I had mastered all the evidence of the case because I was already writing a book about it. And one of the jurors reveals that...
Prospective
jurors, okay. A woman, reveals that her husband is a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, the judge is going to get rid of her.
A Boston police officer?
A Revere police officer.
Ah.
The town next door, northern side of Boston, Revere.
So she's the wife of a Revere cop.
A Revere police officer.
And what do Revere cops think about Boston cops?
Well, that's what was the turning point in this juror. Get it? So I assume the judge is going to throw her off automatically. You won't have to use one of your challenges because she's married
to a cop.
The judge does not disqualify her on his own. So now we have to use a challenge. My father has to use one of his few challenges. And to my astonishment, and to my brother Michael's astonishment, he doesn't challenge her. He asks her a few questions. The other side asks her a few questions. And he does not challenge her. And she ends up on the jury. And her husband is a Revere cop, the town right next door to Boston. And then they immediately go to a recess right after she's seated as a juror. And I jump out of my seat. And my brother Michael jumps out of my seat. And we close in on my old man like he's crazy. Like how could you let her get on this jury?
The wife of a cop.
The wife of a cop. And he says, nobody hates Boston cops more than Revere cops. And nobody knows how bad cops can be more than their wives do. And it dawns on both of us right away, he's completely right. And there's nobody else. There's nobody else practicing law in America at that time who would have let her on the jury. She was, as it turns out, she was with my father all the way through the case. She was one of the strongest, one of his strongest supporters in the jury room. That jury found, you know, from my father's side of the case. Obviously, he won the case, and he won it easily with that jury. there were no holdouts. There was no strain with that jury, and she was with them all the way.
And that was years before this has really become something that we pay.
Yeah, and
a
it's
great
how,
deal
and
of
it's
attention
how
to.
I started my professional life, as it were. It,
now,
because
okay,
I wrote that book.
You wrote the book, and it took you 7 years.
Yeah, it took 7 years.
Okay,
yeah.
Let me. And you said, well, because I didn't know how to write. How long did it take you to write Playing with Fire, the Nixon book?
So the second book, which comes, I don't know, 30 years later, took less than a year.
Okay, so you write this book, and now you're a writer, okay?
Yes.
And then it's done. You're over.
It gets turned into a TV movie, and that puts me in show business.
In show business.
Yeah. And so then I
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So I start hacking around. I joined the Writers Guild in the mid-1980s somewhere, and I start hacking around show business, trying to get, you know, deals. And I got a rewrite deal from Ray Stark on one of those movies that he's had in development for 15 years that he has 8 scripts on,
man.
That kind of thing. You know, I think I never met Ray Stark when I was working, because he had a big company by then.
Sure.
So a development executive gave me the project, and I remember I'd never actually met him in the whole process. So it was
Did the movie get made?
Of course not. Yeah, like 99% of movie scripts that are paid for, it did not get made, and that's the part that the public doesn't know.
Yeah, but you got paid.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, became a dues-paying member of the Writers Guild and all that, and the Writers Guild then goes on strike in 1987, 88. It lasted 6 months, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's when I ended up slipping into politics. Senator Moynihan in New York invited me into his reelection campaign. He kind of knew that I was in a union that was on strike and maybe I needed a paycheck or something. He took, you know, pity on me. And I ended up in that campaign.
And at that point, that was appropriate.
That was correct. It was a correct perception of my situation. And
The pity part, especially.
And I was glad someone pitied me in that situation.
Yeah.
And so it was completely accidental that I ended up in politics. I was not interested in it. I was interested in him as a character. He, fascinating character.
Not really.
Yeah, no, gigantic and fascinating character. And so what I felt I was doing was I felt like I was living The Last Hurrah, which was this novel by Edwin O'Connor that became a movie. And the way that novel is written is it's written by the nephew of the mayor of a city that appears to be Boston, who's running for re-election, this old-time politician, white-haired guy, who's kind of legendary. And the nephew who's writing that first-person account knows nothing about politics. He's kind of the tourist watching this campaign.
So that's
and
that, you.
That's me in the Moynihan 1988 re-election campaign. I contributed exactly nothing to the effort.
Well, he didn't really need anything.
Well, all he needed he got from his wife, Elizabeth Moynihan, who was the campaign manager. So you have the candidate and the campaign manager were the whole story, okay? And $3 million he spends maximum, you know, to get re-elected in New York State with 67% of the vote, you know. And, you know, campaigns in New York State now, they spend $50 million you know, before they even get out of bed. And so it was for me.
What was the margin?
Oh, Moynihan won 67% of the vote, you know, mm-hmm. and then next time he won 68% of the vote. That was a typical Moynihan reelection. You know?
Now, Moynihan, unbelievable public service career.
Mm-hmm.
Ambassador to India?
Ambassador to India, ambassador to the United Nations, worked for 4 presidents in a row, which means Democrat and Republican. President Kennedy, President Johnson, President Nixon, President Ford. In their cabinets, or sub-cabinets in the case of Kennedy, Assistant Secretary of Labor. And a world-class scholar, which is why Harvard wanted him as a professor.
He's the reason that I could get paid to write a book when I was in the Senate, right?
Yes, because there was a time when in the 90s when they were kind of cracking down on outside income. It used to be that senators could give speeches for money, an unlimited amount, right? And then they limited that. So you can give speeches for money, but you can only keep $25,000 a year.
Senators giving speeches for money is such a bad idea.
You have to understand something. Virtually every governor in America can give speeches for money. You know, the kind of ethics and rules that surround senators do not surround the state governments at all.
Jesse Ventura, he refereed a wrestling match for a shitload of money.
While governor.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
And they had action figures.
Right.
Some company made Jesse Ventura action figures.
Yeah. So there came a point in this closing down of what senators could do financially where there was actually this rule for the Senate, which is say that senators could not have any outside earned income. You know, because a lot of them were actually making money as lawyers on the outside also. You know, other ways of making money, right? And all of this was going in the right direction is a good idea. You can have no outside earned income. And so this outraged Senator Moynihan because he had he lived on his government salary and he lived on the, you know, maybe $6,000 a year that would come in book royalties for all of these scholarly books that he wrote that were published by Oxford University Press over, you know, 40-year period. And this was going to say, you know, that Senator Moynihan's book income is illegitimate and he should not have it because that somehow corrupts him. So he did work to get book royalties exempted from this outside income rule and succeeded. And so when you were a senator, you were able to have outside income on book royalties.
And that's why Bernie is...
That's why Bernie's now, quote, a millionaire because he made a lot of money on a book.
You know, he's kind of... He had to adjust to that.
Yeah.
Because, well, Chris, his stump speech was always like, this country is controlled by the millionaires and the billionaires. And this cycle, he's had to go, and he's had a hard time doing this. He's going, this country is controlled by the billionaires and the multi-billionaires. That's because politicians get their money from the the billionaires and multi-billionaires. And we have to stop the system. We have to stop the system because everything now is controlled by the the billionaires and multi-billionaires. And let's face it, soon it's going to be trillionaires because of inflation. You know, in 1961, Hollywood had a film called How to Marry a Millionaire. At that time, a hamburger cost 15 cents. I paid $17 for a hamburger at this hotel they put me up. I didn't put myself up there. They put me up, and that's over 100 times what it was in 1961. So I have like $10,000 is what I'm saying.
But that's true. You know, this millionaire label, millionaire label, I think should mean the person has an income per year of $1 million or more. The idea of having assets of $1 million now in a country where, you know, middle class houses on Staten Island are worth $800,000 and more it's ridiculous, these labels. You know.
I don't think it's important. I think people know what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
Okay. So, sorry for the tangent. Working for Moynihan, and you have in the Senate an incredibly important job.
Yeah, I thought, you know, I was only going to work in the reelection campaign, and then the senator invited me onto the Senate staff, and I had no idea what I could do there. And so I started off being housed in his New York City office and going down to Washington frequently. And then my involvement in Washington got deeper and deeper, and I eventually became full-time Washington staff. And then Senator Moynihan became a chairman for the first time. He became chairman of Environment and Public Works, and he asked me to run the committee, be the so-called staff director of the Environment and Public Works.
Very, very, very important.
Hugely
position.
Important. It's the staff directors are the most important staff positions in the Senate. Those are way bigger than just senators, chiefs of staff in the office. And sadly, the job doesn't exist anymore because they don't govern that way anymore. They basically don't govern, as you know, but they don't govern through committees anymore. So someone has my job, they have that business card, but they don't do anything.
There's still some, but it's really, the place is broken, we see. Okay, so you have this incredibly important staff position, and then your Senate career ends.
Yeah.
And you don't go to K Street.
No, so when I became the staff director of the Finance Committee, there's a tradition there where the former staff directors come and visit you. And there's a book, there's a little book in the staff director's desk that actually lists all of the previous staff directors. And I was fascinated. I knew I'd heard of some of them. They were kind of legendary, and I was waiting for them to come because I was hoping they could teach me stuff. And some of them did teach me things about how the job should be done. Even the ones who I thought were legendary, I would look at their tenure because I thought, oh boy, he was like staff director forever, wasn't he? And you look at it and go, he was staff director for a year and a half. You know, and this one was staff director for a year. They were almost all of them were staff director for a year. And the reason for that is the day you become staff director of the finance committee, you immediately become worth $1 million down the street as a lobbyist immediately. And, you know, you've got kids at home and you're thinking about this and you're making a government salary. And so they all feel the pull of that lobbyist job and it pulls them out. And so I'm one of the longest serving staff directors because one thing I knew at the start was, well, I'm never going to be a lobbyist, you know, and which is, you know, really rare and possibly, you know, the only one who did that. And when I left, I just went back to my writing life and I kind of reconnected into Hollywood. And not long after that, luckily, NBC ordered episodes of The West Wing, and Aaron Sorkin immediately asked me to become a writer on the staff of The West Wing. And that was, you know, just a great, great.
I'm not familiar with that show.
Yeah.
But when we come back, let's talk about West Wing. We have to take a break. And we'll be right back with Lawrence O'Donnell Jr.
When the news cycle gets busy, it can be tough to keep up with healthy habits. Thrive Market makes it easy to get high-quality groceries delivered right to your door so you can focus on what matters. They carry trusted brands like Rouse and Chomps, and every product is free from over 1,000 sketchy ingredients. With Thrive Market, you can restock your pantry with clean snacks and staples, all without leaving the couch. Go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and get 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
We're back, and I'm with Lawrence O'Donnell Jr., the host of The Last Word on MSNBC. And it's not The Last Word anymore, is it?
There are some words after I actually say, that is tonight's last word.
Now
the eleventh hour with Brian Williams is next. It's like, well, what words did you leave for Brian? We left an hour's worth.
Okay, so West Wing, unbelievable, great show, obviously, and unbelievable cast.
Yeah.
Unbelievable writing staff. I guess. Well. Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah. Aaron carried the first 4 years of the writing, and then he left, and then the last 3 years of the writing, was a
and Wells team. Took over.
John Wells, who was the executive producer of ER. The reason The West Wing exists is because of John Wells, because the network rejected it. When Aaron wrote the script, the network rejected it. They didn't want to make it. John Wells had the power, because he was running ER, to, in effect, a year later, force them to make the pilot by leveraging it against another pilot they wanted John to make, which he did make. And then John, you know, used his power to force it onto the air because it didn't test very well. You know, it was an odd-looking thing for the audiences they assembled to test it. And then it soared, you know, in the ratings right away. I mean, when that first ratings report came in on a Thursday after that Wednesday 9 p.m. premiere, you know, we were walking across the Warner Brothers lot and we knew our lives had just changed.
It's odd that every once in a while TV executives don't know that their head is up their asshole.
Well, we're all human and they sometimes are wrong about what the audience will actually like, you know, and so the audience really went with this. And by the way, to my personal surprise, because I remember by the time we had written five of them, we just had a read through of the fifth one, right? And we're walking across the Warner Brothers lot, and I'm with Rick Cleveland, who's one of the first year writers who ended up winning the writing Emmy with Aaron Sorkin in the first year. And I say to Rick, you know, I'm thinking like, okay, the audience has seen like 4 hours of this now. And I say, by now they realize You know, no episodes on the air yet. Okay, I'm predicting the audience's reaction to the work we've done so far. And I said, by now they realize nothing happens. By now they know there's no baby dying in the emergency room and no one's getting, you know, the cops aren't chasing anybody.
It's not a procedural.
Anybody. Yeah, they've seen everything we know how to do, which is true. I mean, the first four episodes of The West Wing, that has everything we know how to do. They're not going to keep watching this after this, right? And I was luckily completely wrong about that.
As you've been
It turns out I've been... There are moments when I've been wrong. I just thought I'd bring
you
one of those.
You said Trump
here.
Wouldn't run this time,
I said he wouldn't run last time, yeah. Right. Yeah.
But you had said that every
time. I was right every time before that.
You were right every time until you weren't right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So, and when he assembles the staff... you're the only guy with government experience.
Yeah, so, and that's why I was grabbed immediately, because they knew there's like one guy in the Writers Guild who's actually, you know, worked in Washington and government and been in the Oval Office and real governing meetings and in the cabinet room and all that stuff. And so it was, I had a massive advantage as a writer on that show. It was a great, and that was my first television series writing. I've since done a bunch of other ones, but it was great that the first one put me in the position of literally highest authority as a writer there in terms of the material we were working with. But not...
You know, you had consultants on the show, Dee Dee Myers and those people who presumably were supposed to do a little bit of that.
Yeah.
But they're not writers, and they are... they're not there every day.
It's the there every day part that's the most important thing. And in a 22-episode show, if you're in the writer's room every day, that's a very different kind of contribution than a consultant who comes in once a month or less.
And you're just...
for a couple of hours.
You're just trying to get ideas for,
right,
from
right.
them, right?
And the challenge with consultants on any show, including like the physicians on the hospital shows, is... the consultant has to have a writerly mind. The good consultant is the one who comes in with an idea about what works for your show, because most writers don't know anything about medicine, right? So they don't even know the question to ask the consultant about the hospital show. They don't know what the question is. It's very hard to find people who have lived the life you're writing about, but also have lived it with a writerly eye and know what to look for.
Okay, so you're doing West Wing, and that's just a great period.
It really is. It's a real high point. It's really great.
And you leave it at one point to do Mr. Sterling.
Yeah, so I do the first 2 years of West Wing, then I leave to create my own show, which is also on NBC, which is with Josh Brolin starring as an appointed senator. Which is something, when you're working on the Senate staff, you're always sitting around thinking about if so-and-so, you know, something happened, who would they appoint? Mm-hmm. And you kind of play this game in your head, you know? And I'd play that game in my head, and then I got
so
to
write. So Senator Crooks.
Yes, and the reason I say that is because when I was there, there was a plane crash that suddenly changed everything, you know? And so it kind of brings it to mind, you know, that can happen. And it's a very dramatic scenario, you know, and that was the Mr. Smith goes to Washington scenario. The original big Washington drama was a senator dies, who do we appoint? It's just a great dramatic
structure. And he's appointed, and it turns out he's really an independent.
Yeah.
And he gets there, and it's a divided Senate, and he uses his position brilliantly in order to get some power, and the series failed.
Yes, he does it. He does it. He's a brilliant senator for about 12 episodes,
that's the hardest you've ever worked.
Hardest I've ever worked in my life.
Okay, that brings me to,
which is crazy that show running a TV drama is the hardest thing in the world. Shouldn't be. There should be things harder than that.
I'm sure being president.
I think coal mining. You know, yeah.
Well, that's a different.
Commercial fishermen. I've seen those shows.
Those are dangerous jobs.
Yeah, those are hard. Yeah.
So, okay, you work really hard there. Yeah. Unbelievably. You're exhausted.
And then I come back to the West Wing. When my show gets canceled, John Wells asked me to come back to the West Wing, which I do for the last three seasons. And being, you know, like a basically a writing staff instead of doing the job John Wells is doing, which is running the show, was like being in retirement. It was fantastic. You know, I only wrote one script for the West Wing the first season I was back because I was so burnt out. And then by the last season...
Well, you're pitching stuff, though. You're pitching, breaking stories.
I physically wrote the script myself. I did a lot of story. I did a lot of story for a lot of episodes.
Yeah, but I want to get past that because I want to cover a lot of stuff here that I haven't covered. Which brings me to last word. My sense in talking to you is that is not hard.
Oh, it's not hard. It's not, I'll put it this way, it's not as hard as running a TV show, running a TV drama. It's not as hard as running the staff of the Senate Finance Committee. Not at all as hard as that. Not as hard as writing a book. So it's not in the top rung of degree of difficulty of things I've done. I'm not saying it's easy. It's not easy,
and
it's also more mysterious because with all those other things, writing when you're on a TV series or writing scripts, you can't really say when your day begins and ends because it's kind of in your head when you're driving. It's kind of
you've got a schedule. You're on TV at 10.
Right. This thing invades your life all the time. I try to schedule my day to avoid contact with what I'm going to be dealing with professionally on the show at 10 o'clock.
Why you're doing this?
I'm doing this right now to avoid knowing,
what's
happening. Yeah, because I want to come
to the president said something crazy.
I want to come to the information as late as possible because the later I come to that information, the clearer it will be. So, you know, you can get Trump's tweet 9:17 a.m., like a minute after it comes out, and go, oh, you know, what does this mean? Or you can look at Trump's 9:17 a.m. tweet at 4:30 p.m.
Or at 9:17 p.m.
And you'll know what it means.
You see what I did there?
Because the framing of what's going on will be much clearer. You know, especially in this situation where we are constantly throwing away the show we thought we were going to do because the New York Times or the Washington Post or... A prosecutor has just revealed something new that throws our show off.
I think you're sometimes at your best when, you know, Soleimani gets killed.
Well, I like the completely throw away the script show and just go live. Because
you don't have to write.
I don't feel any responsibility at that point because I didn't write anything. It's like this is, I'm not presenting you. This isn't my idea about what to present. We just got buried.
But you've written something in case something didn't break.
I've got a whole show written, and I feel responsible for that.
And you write your opening, right?
And I can personally be embarrassed for how good it isn't. But if it's just a totally breaking news thing with no scripts, then I have nothing to be embarrassed
about. Are you embarrassed that your openings are not as well researched as Rachel's?
They are.
They're not in the same universe.
No, they're not. No.
She works incredibly hard.
She does. And so.
And you don't.
I don't work as hard as Rachel. And I can tell you that there's nobody in the television news business who works as hard as Rachel. And I don't believe there ever has been anyone in the television news business who works as hard as Rachel. And you can see it. In that hour, I do think, and I personally search the world for excuses for laziness. So I really love them, and I'm a collector of them. I would say, just in programming terms, when you're coming after a show where the opening has been a 25-minute kind of brilliant tour of one person on a TV screen telling you this story,
starting with something that has nothing to do,
right?
Very tangentially tied to what she wants to say.
Rhythmically, you probably don't want to do that again. To start off the 10 o'clock
fucking excuse.
It is a great excuse.
Wow.
No, I'm a collector of excuses for laziness.
But that means you're loose. That means you're happy.
But look, I've done...
You would not be happy if you worked as hard as Rachel.
I think that's a fair statement.
Okay.
But no, I'll put it this way. I've worked as hard as Rachel in the past in other occupations.
Yeah, yeah.
Not in this.
Yeah. And you're older. You're getting old.
A little bit, yeah.
Rachel's young.
I have done 25-minute opening blocks. I have done 15
minutes. I know. I've seen them. You don't have to justify your existence.
No, what I'm saying is I could do one tonight
if the situation
called for it, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
But I ain't going to do it every night. There's no way.
Okay, I want to ask about MSNBC because to me, now, the hosts are different and take different tacks in how they address things. But to me, it's all the same show.
Mm-hmm.
It's the host, it's the three lawyers from, you know, the Southern District, the Eastern District, and Northern District of New York, the former prosecutors. And you don't go like, what are you guys doing? Well, of course, we're doing the news of the day and the big thing that happened today. And you are too. And there are people who watch the whole thing. They watch from, I don't know, Chris Hayes on or from...
There's plenty of people who tell me they watch 4 hours starting with Chris Hayes through to Brian.
How do they do that?
I've never done it, so I don't know.
Wow.
But I have no argument with any audience perception of television because everybody in the audience has their own perception of it. I can't say that's an incorrect perception of it. And so that kind of view of they're all the same show is exactly precisely where I arrived somewhere around age 26 about football games. It's all the same game, and I never watched another football game. Never. And I played football in high school. I cared about it, all that stuff. There came a moment where I just went, I've seen every single thing they're ever going to do. I don't care. I never watch it.
It's live athletics. Guys are...
I don't care.
Just unbelievably...
Oh, stop it. It's all happened before. There's nothing...
It's happened before.
Oh, don't tell me that the ball tipped off of his fingers onto that guy's helmet and then the other guy caught it. I know. It's happened before. Every single thing that's ever going to happen in a football game has happened before. I don't care about any of it.
First of all, that's not true.
It's the same show.
The Minnesota Miracle.
Every NFL game is the same show.
Let's not argue about that.
I won that argument, right? There's no question.
Okay, I'll give you that one. Because you're wrong, but everybody knows it. So I want to ask you about cable news, because you've got CNN, which is sort of, we're playing it down the middle, except we hate Trump.
No, they don't. One-third of the people on their payroll love Trump. So you're guaranteed on any hour of CNN to minimum one-third of the programming will be supportive of Trump. Someone on their payroll saying, here's why Trump's right.
Yeah, well, they bring someone on to do that. But
their hosts don't do that. Their hosts don't, but that's one of the reasons why Trump kind of wants you to watch CNN instead of MSNBC.
Sure.
Because he knows on MSNBC there will be no one defending him because we don't bring on liars. I don't bring on a liar. I won't do that. And there's no one on CNN who...
Are you saying that to defend Trump, you have to lie?
Yes. Absolutely.
Of course.
Yes. How else do you defend a liar? A pathological liar who lies about everything. You have to lie. So CNN has people on the payroll who they pay to tell their lies to the CNN audience in the middle of, you know, a CNN hour for some number of minutes. And so Trump knows that if you watch CNN, at least you'll hear someone lying in my favor. So that's one of the reasons why he attacks CNN.
Which brings us to Fox.
Yeah.
It's gotten worse?
Yeah, it's gotten way worse. Way, way, way worse. Yeah, just like the Republican Party in the Senate and the House have gotten way, way worse. And they get worse every year of Trump.
Mitch McConnell.
Wow. I knew Mitch McConnell when he was an honorable guy in the 1990s.
Holy crap.
He was the Republican chairman of the Senate Ethics Committee, and he recommended the expulsion of the Republican chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. I mean,
was that Packwood?
Well, Packwood, and the senator resigned instead of getting expelled. I mean, Mitch McConnell just played it right down the middle in the most honorable possible way when he was chairman of the Ethics Committee.
Okay, well, then that would be 180 degrees.
Yeah, it's stunning.
You know, even before Obama is sworn in, after he's elected, he tells his caucus, we're just going to stop him from anything.
Well, the big problem is he said it publicly.
But at that time, the economy is tanking. It's the worst economy since the Great Depression, you'd think.
Yes, you would.
Yeah. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would.
You'd think, you know what? Let's try to help.
I guess what they would have, the older version of that spiritually, they might, and the older version of that, I don't think they even would have said it out loud. But what they would have said is, look, we all understand we're going to have to do something about this economic situation. We're going to have to do something. I don't know if we're going to be able to find a way to compromise with Democrats about this, but we got to work toward trying to see if we can, see if there's something reasonable. After that, we're just going to kill them on everything. Like, that would have been the older school version of it.
But that's not what happened.
And no.
Finally, they got three.
Yeah.
They got Snow and Collins and Specter, who then later became a Democrat. And the reason they needed three was that so none of them could be the vote that did it. You see? Mm-hmm. So, anyway, but it's a very watered-down stimulus package. And then they're blaming him for the unemployment rates and lying about all kinds of shit. And then it's on and on and on. But Merrick Garland is the piece de resistance.
That's the moment when you knew for certain that it was hopeless. That it's hopeless. You know, that it's absolutely
and
hopeless.
And he keeps...
There is nothing the Republican Senate will ever do that in any way is rational and is any kind of compromise with Democrats.
And he keeps quoting the Biden rule, which came from a part of a speech. Mm-hmm. And in later in the speech, he says, now, if you consult with us or pick a moderate, I'll gladly get behind that. And that's exactly who Merrick Garland was.
Yeah.
So, and now, a few months ago, he's asked, what would you do if a vacancy came up next year? Right. And he said, we'll fill it.
Right, McConnell, yeah.
And that, to me...
And he laughed when he said it, because he's laughing at, what, did you believe me the first time?
Okay, so, well, you're the progressive station. Fair to say?
Yeah, I'll take that.
Okay.
I believe that what I do in my hour, what Rachel does, what Chris Hayes does, is we discuss everything in a completely honest way. And that sounds partisan. It sound in today's era because the Republican Party is just nonstop lying.
But let me ask you something. Democrats have a hearing in judiciary. Mm-hmm. And they don't do a good job.
They never do. That's the truth of it. I mean, they were not, you know these people.
But you don't say that.
Oh, I've said it. I've said it different times, sure. Yeah.
But you don't say so-and-so was bad.
It's not, I don't think this sort of stylistic reporting of what went on in the hearing, that actually has never really interested me. What has always interested me about hearings having
that
worked in...
That always interested me as
a viewer.
No, as a member of the committee.
Yeah.
Because I was disappointed at some of the judiciary hearings on Kavanaugh, on Bill Barr. That was a real opportunity. And... You know, I had a performing background and knew how to create a moment, and I feel like my former colleagues don't.
No, and they don't have performing backgrounds. And so, of course, they're not going to be able to deliver this the way, you know, television critics want them to. And my experience in hearings and training in
hearings...
It's
not television critics so much. It's about creating a moment that gets on TV.
Right. Yeah.
That's
what
it is.
They don't know how to do that. But that's that's performing. You have to have that. Normally, that takes writing. You're both a writer and a performer. Okay, so you need senators who have staffers who think that way and know how to think that way, and they don't generally. You then need senators who know how to deliver it, and they don't generally. Even if you laid it out for them, this is exactly how to perform this, they wouldn't know how to perform it. And then it's interactive, and the way you plan to do this might not work with this particular witness.
No, you have to listen to the witness all the time. You have to listen because they...
Well, now you're talking about improvising, which just about no one can do.
But there are tells. Like with Gorsuch, I had not planned to do the frozen trucker.
Mm-hmm.
But Dick Durbin laid it out, and I could see that Gorsuch was very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tell my, judiciary counsel, I say, we got some time. Research, tell me about this. And I just could see he was uncomfortable, and I went right at him.
Yeah, yeah. But, my experience in hearings is sitting there behind senators and seeing that every single word, that Lloyd Benson is going to say in this hearing, including every question, is written, and he doesn't deviate from it. And he's not the only one. That's true of most of them. And so hearings are always going to be disappointing at a performative level because of the people who we have in these jobs. And nobody runs for these jobs saying, I'm going to be the best cross-examiner you've ever seen. And they're not. And so I go in with an extremely low expectation for that. And I believe my job on hearings is to say, here's what's important of what was said in that hearing. Here is the important point that was made in that hearing. I don't care, whether this senator or House member on the way to making that point stumbled over the words and had to read it and it looked terrible. I care what the
actual information is. No, what I'm saying is moments get on TV.
Yeah.
And if you can get Bill Barr, he said that the Mueller report, when he introduced it, he just lied.
Right. And that, CNN fell for every one of those lies, 100%. If you ever looked at the coverage of CNN the night Bill Barr released his little note, about the report, it was
Well, there was a note, and then there was the press conference before, which was just hideous. Okay, we got 5 minutes. Okay, what should we talk about? Oh, KIND?
Yes, we should talk about the KIND Fund, which is the thing that really keeps me very happily doing my job, is using this show as a forum to be able to do something beyond the show. And so we created Kids in Need of Desks, which is this program I created in Malawi, where we've now...
Why Malawi?
Because it was totally accidental. A friend of mine had just returned from Malawi. She's a school teacher. She said to me, they need desks. They don't have any desks. That's what all the teachers ask for. And I said, couldn't we do something about that? And I didn't even know why I said those words. And then I found myself going over there and trying to figure out how to do it. I eventually found a guy in the capital city who knew how to make desks. And in 1 week, he made 30 of them for me to deliver to one classroom the first time I was there. Just paid him with cash out of my pocket. And then when I came back, I started talking about it on the show. And I knew when I talked about it publicly, I'm going to need a way for people to respond the way I did to this need. And so I partnered with UNICEF so they could process credit cards and all that kind of stuff. And UNICEF has fantastic infrastructure in Malawi. And so we started doing it. And this, we've now raised about $25 million in the
How many desks have you provided?
Almost a quarter of a million at this point, and there will be, since we just raised $3 million this holiday season, which is gigantic for us, that's going to be
a lot
more.
It seems to be building.
Yeah. What's great about this year is I talked about it less on the show this year than ever, and the contributions were more because people have made it a habit already.
Mm-hmm.
And so we put desks in schools and we provide scholarships for girls to attend
because
high school.
Girls in a lot of countries, they send their sons to school and not the girl. Yeah, and they can't afford it. They have to pay.
Yeah, there's no free public high school in countries like Malawi, and so you have to pay a little bit of tuition, and most families are going to spend that tuition, if they have it, on a boy instead of a girl. And so the girl's graduation rate is like half the boy's rate, and so we're trying to push that up. And that's been fantastic, because I met a lot of these girls, and now some of our girls are in college, which is just the dream come true. It's just phenomenal. And it's just, I think, a very important thing to do with the kind of TV real estate that I have. If this run of this show came to an end and I hadn't done something like that, I just can't imagine how I would feel about looking back on that.
What about helping Americans, Lawrence?
You get that all the time, and anyone who wants to do that is free to do that. You know, I get it. If you think I'd rather...
You only had one shot at this, to do something to help kids, and you'd think that, you know, there are a lot of American kids who need help, Lawrence.
I have no debate point on that. I've chosen to do what I'm doing.
Well, okay, some of us care about America. And I think on that note, no, it's a great thing. Yeah. It's a great thing.
No, and
I kid.
And it makes you, you know, I have one of these desks in my office, because it's there to remind me, you know, on the days where I think, why am I still doing this? Well, that's why we're still doing it, you know, because we at minimum, you got to keep doing this because we need more desks.
Well, we'll link to it. How's that?
Oh, great. That'd be great.
On our,
thank you for that.
On this. And keep up the good work. Okay, everybody, we got to go. Lawrence, I didn't get to everything I wanted to. That's how fascinating you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, everybody, give to the kids in need of desks. We'll provide a link to it.
Lastworddesks.msnbc.com.
There you go. Goodbye, everybody. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing. We'll talk again next week.